title of his talk today is Understanding How Marine Environmental Factors Control Early Marine Survival of Salmon in Alaska, Where to Measure What for Stock Assessment of Chinook Salmon in the Coastal Waters of Alaska. Phil.
Okay, so I'm filled with confidence here because I'm looking at the screen and I don't see my presentation.
Good morning.
That's a bad start.
Bad sign, huh?
Who's hiding?
So anyway, I'm not gonna give up any of my time to Eric here. I want to say good morning and thanks very much to the organizing committee, and to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for inviting, us here to, see so many of our old friends and colleagues. Okay. Alrighty then. Well, I think the job of this panel is to put a little salt on the table. And, since I'm going to introduce talks by, three scientists who have spent their careers, working in the marine environment to understand salmon, I need to tell you that Chinook salmon is a marine species. It spends the majority, vast majority of its life in the ocean, and it gains the vast majority of its biomass in the ocean. So to those of us who don't know any better, it might seem odd that we don't spend more time studying salmon in the ocean. I am here to take a look at three questions that we picked out of the list of questions that were asked by the organizing committee. It's really important to understand what we need to study in the marine environment, particularly for juvenile stock assessment, but also for marine processes. And these are the processes that are concerned with birth, growth, and death in the marine environment. And also take a little look at what new techniques and projects could be brought to bear in estimating abundance of juvenile chinook. And then maybe just briefly mention how nearshore surveys and process studies can help us understand a little bit more about the abundance trends that we're seeing. So this is something to keep in mind. Get out your Google Earth and take a look at it. Alaska is a huge place, and even those of us who've spent our careers working here tend to forget that from time to time. You're looking at about 1,400 miles of real estate on that red line there, and you cover a lot of latitude. The answers for each Chinook population, and particularly those that live in the north, are going to be very different when you move into the marine environment, because the answers depend on hydrography. That's the currents, the thymmetry, the bottom topography, the productivity, and the food web structure. These are the four criteria that we use to define large marine ecosystems in the marine environment, and these are going to be the same things that we're going to be looking at when we study Chinook salmon in the nearshore environment. So the good place to start to structure our discussions is the critical size and period hypothesis here. We got a little cartoon that shows Lee Rubin's version of the CSP, the critical size and period hypothesis, and it makes salmon moms sound kind of like drill sergeants. But the fact of the matter is that what we often see, where we get a chance to measure it, is that salmon, when they enter the marine environment, die at very high rates for periods of 40 to 50 days or so. And that's the first sort of knot hole that they get yanked through when they hit the environment. And then the second one is during the winter, the first winter at sea, when the salmon are entering a time when they may not have as much food available to them, and when they're not going to be able to do much about adding fat to their bodies. So how big they get by the end of the summer is really important, we believe. That's another critical size for the fish, and they need to get big enough and fat enough to make it through the first winter. There are people on this panel who've published on this, and evidence has been accumulating for a long time. The best known proponents of the CSP are Dick Beamish and Connie Minkin. So where to measure what? The basic CSP formula is pretty clear. You work in the migratory exit path first, the estuary, the near shore, and the coastal waters. What are you going to study? Sources of mortality and growth. Predators, the abundance and distribution and size of predators is really key. Food, availability, quality, the prey species, and the lipid content of the prey species. And of course, size of age, because salmon in the marine environment grow in order to avoid being eaten. Well, what do we know about salmon in the marine environment? Actually, we know a lot. In the last 20 years, there's been a virtual explosion in knowledge of fisheries oceanography in the nearshore environment in Alaska. If you take a look at the at studies that are at the top there, the first five, and you add up the approximate budget for those, it's around $82 million. That's not counting the ones that are down on the bottom there. And Lieutenant Governor Treadwell yesterday mentioned the studies in Prince William Sound. This is called the Sound Ecosystem Assessment, SEA. And this is published in a volume of fisheries oceanography. And you should definitely check this out if you study salmon in the marine environment, because there's a wealth of information in there. Ocean carrying capacity worked in the northern Gulf of Alaska in the 90s, and it morphed into the basis, the Bering Aleutian Salmon International Survey, and Ed Farley is here to tell you about that. And then we have the Southeast Coastal Monitoring Project, which works in the coastal waters of Southeast Alaska, and Joe Orsi is here to tell you about that. The Globex study from the they call it the Northeast Pacific, that's well represented in publications by Tom Klein, but I'm not really going to address that here. Then we have the area of high sea salmon research, and Kate Myers is here to tell you about that. And finally, we just concluded a $52 million five-year study in the Bering Sea. It was funded by the North Pacific Research Board and the National Science Foundation, the Bering Sea Integrated Ecosystem Research Program. And again, this is another physics to fish kind of study. We learned a tremendous amount about the Bering Sea, and that publication is just out. Again, this is another must-have publication. And then we're just getting going in the Gulf of Alaska on the Integrated Ecosystem Research Program, and that's going to be similar to the Bering Sea program, but probably not as well funded. So the Sound Ecosystem Assessment, when I tell you, just give you two little looks at this. First thing I would point out is Mark Ouellette's got a number of excellent studies in this volume of fisheries oceanography. And this was one of the most intense looks using physical, chemical, and biological oceanography and juvenile salmon at the ecology of a nearshore environment in Alaska. And Mark found that it wasn't just the zooplankton density that determined the survival of the fish and the growth of the fish. Actually, when they had low zooplankton density in the nearshore environment, the fish were drawn offshore to find more food, and they ran into predator fields. They ran into, it was mostly pollock, and the mortality rates went up five times. So if you were just looking in the nearshore environment at food and salmon, you would see low density of zooplankton, and you say, yep, that's it, they're not getting enough to eat. But actually, they were getting enough to eat. They were just getting it to eat in the wrong place, and they were dying for it. He also found that it's the size of the predators is really important. So not just the coincidence of predators with the juvenile salmon, but the size of the predators. So the overall, the Sound Ecosystem Assessment, during the 90s, it was a $25 million project, and it was directed at understanding mechanisms of salmon and herring production. I think that what we've learned about herring is also pretty interesting, but I'm not gonna talk about that. I just point out to you that the herring populations in Prince William Sound currently have no surplus production. that is natural mortality, barely allows them to replace themselves. That's a cautionary tale. The major salmon findings, in addition to Mark Ouellette's studies, ocean atmospheric processes, really do have a heavy influence on survival of salmon in the nearshore environment. One thing that we were able to find out was that the wind-driven circulation, can concentrate zooplankton in onshore areas. So you get a high density of food depending on the wind. The salmon don't have to go offshore to find food. They not only get a lot to eat, they also avoid the predators. So the wind in Prince William Sound is very important in determining whether the salmon survive. So coastal marine research questions go back to the first question. What are the marine environmental variables appropriate to stock assessment and the marine process studies? Again, I think the record's pretty clear. Juvenile growth and abundance, food distribution and quality, prey species, predator species and size. These are all things that we study in our coastal marine surveys, the Southeast Coastal Monitoring of Joe Worsley's talk, and the Bering Aleutian Salmon International Survey of Ed Farley. The you can go to sea and you can study these things, or you can sit in your armchair and use NOAA data, which is what I like to do. And the we call these physical proxies. So here's a paper. It's a pretty heavy duty slide by Seth Danielson. Seth Danielson is a physical oceanographer at University of Alaska Fairbanks who studies the Northern Bering Sea. And this paper is just out. The important thing to look at here is the Bering Strait. This is sort of the bathtub drain for the Bering Sea. Sooner or later, all the water that comes across the shelf in the Bering Sea is going to go out the Bering Straits. We know that for a fact, but what it does before it goes down this bathtub drain up here is pretty vital to determining the survival of salmon in the nearshore environment. And here we've got winds that come from the southeast in red and winds that come from the northwest in blue. And you can see there's two insets here, one from October to April and one from May to September. And representing the late fall and winter and early spring times, when you can see that the northwest winds are much higher frequency than they are in the May through September time period. And the red vectors represent the direction of the water flow. The size of the vector shows you how fast it's going. And when the wind blows from the southeast, everything works the way that it's supposed to. The water heads up towards the bathtub drain and everything's fine. But when the wind blows in the opposite direction, you're going to get patterns, circulation patterns. You see the blue arrows are going back in the other direction. And this has got to be very important in allowing the Chinook salmon that are coming out of western Alaska to find their way to the shelf break where all the food is. So also under physical proxies for CSP variables, there's a paper out in the Bering Sea Integrated Ecosystem Research Program volume that I mentioned that's just out. This is not about salmon. It's about benthic ecology, but they spent a lot of time trying to figure out where the food that goes to the benthic habitat comes from and how it circulates. And using satellite measurements, productivity, wind, ice cover, surface air temperature, and products from real-time sensors up there, they were able to paint a picture for the Northern Bering Sea, which is the habitat of the Yukon juvenile Chinook when they come out. It shows that sometimes the food will be there for them and sometimes it won't. And again, I think that if that's the case, then these physical proxies ought to be pretty important. Well, here's a slide. Those of you who go to meetings may have seen this slide before. This is probably one of the most popular slides to explain the importance of water column stability on the production of food in the marine environment, particularly in the Bering Sea, where ice is extremely important. And you can see in the upper panel there, you've got early ice retreat, you've got wind that reaches the surface of the water. It's early ice retreat, so there's no sun, so the bloom is late. You have relatively warm water, and you get mostly small copepods out of it. Small copepods are better for some fish than others, so you get an advantage to some fish. Late ice retreat, you get an early bloom. You get relatively cold water because the ice is still there to chill the water. And you get very large copepods. So this is the oscillatory control hypothesis. It's been modified by Quayle et al., and one of the authors of Quayle et al. Is Farley, who's here with us today. This is an example of how I think you've got to use physical data in the environment. I'm not a big fan of the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. I think it served its purpose. I pointed out the importance of marine variables in determining the survival of salmon in the ocean, but it's a very blunt instrument. It's a large geographic average. I think you've got to use physical data at the times and locations when the fish are present. This is the area that I work in to forecast the timing of adult Chinook salmon. Point out that this is exactly the same pathway that the fish are going to be on when they're juveniles and they're coming back out into the marine environment. We use the ice cover in the marine staging area here, the percent ice cover. We use a sea surface temperature located here, and we use the surface air temperature from Nome to match physical observations to the location of the fish, and we also use models of the physiology of the fish about how they interact with the marine environment. So this is this is the looking for the needle in the haystack, Chinook salmon timing the lower Yukon River. And you can see that we've got a lot of data, a lot of experience out there. And the 50% point is normally the 21st of June, but the 50% point can really be anywhere between the 10th of June and the 30th of June. If you're a salmon manager and you're trying to get salmon up the river to Canada, this is a very nervous business, and you really need a little bit of prior information about this timing. And this is the model that found the needle. It does a really good job of fitting the historical data to the predictions. And you can see the open circles there are predictions, and the dark circles are observations. And I put these red arrows in to show the times. These are the times that we don't want in a field situation or in a real operational forecast. And that's when the prediction is on the wrong side of the long-term mean. So here we told them it was going to be a little early, and it turned out to be a little late on that model prediction. But only 16% of those 49 variables actually turned out that way. This is work that I published with Danny Evanson in 2011. And just wanted to also point out before I move on with that we've done operational forecasting of timing on the Yukon River, and for 3 years we've been pretty much on mark for that time. Again, matching physical variables to the location and time when the fish are there is a good way to go. So back to talking about where to measure what, the basic CSP formula. You can work in the migratory exit path, predators, food, and size at age, or you can find a good coastal marine location. So this is from Joe Orsi's talk. I modified the slide here, and I put up on the slide the one-half CSP, because in this case, the Southeast Coastal Monitoring Survey is not looking at the period of overwinter survival. It's only looking at the first half of that CSP. You know, that's the marine entry. And it appears pretty much that Southeast Coastal Monitoring, which works in the summertime, manages to get at the fish, get at the pink salmon from Southeast Alaska after they've had most of their early marine mortality. And it also appears that the overwinter mortality is not often very important. There's one year there, the 2005 ocean year, when the forecast didn't work particularly well. This is a forecast that's issued in November for July and August of the following year. So these numbers are, the National Weather Service, I'm sure, would love to have a forecast that's this good, this far in advance. I've also labeled it a stock recruitment curve, which it is. Not much of a curve, though, is it? And that's because this is an estimate of stock size in the marine environment and matched up against recruitment. I know that harvest is not escapement, but the correlation between harvest levels and escapement in Southeast Alaska is better than 0.9 over most years of record. So here we have an example of being in the right place at the right time. And a program that's been funded by NOAA and by the Northern Fund of the Pacific Salmon Treaty that's been highly successful at doing marine stock recruitment. So moving on to what new techniques, projects could be brought to bear in estimating abundance in the near shore. Coastal marine surveys. As I mentioned at the start of the talk, Alaska's a big place. Just about every circumstance on marine entry is going to be different. We have experience from the BASIS program up in the area between St. Lawrence Island and the Yukon Delta. We have experience in the eastern Bering Sea where the Kuskokwim and then the Nushagak are going to be. This area, the northern Gulf of Alaska, we know quite a bit about, where the fish from the Kenai and the Susitna are coming out. And of course, Southeast Alaska, Southeast Coastal Monitoring. I mentioned our Gulf of Alaska Integrated Ecosystem Research Program is, currently working, in these areas. So these are areas we know, coastal marine surveys are quite feasible, and we know how to catch fish in these areas. So, the other thing for new projects is I note that every salmon's a low-cost, biological, autonomous underwater vehicle. Okay. So these things are launched every year in their millions, and they cover thousands of miles of ocean, coastal habitat, and they come right back to us. We just need to learn how to download the data. So in this category, I put the things that I call downloading the data from the autonomous underwater vehicles. Lipids. What are they eat? Stable isotopes. Where do they eat on the food web, the trophic level? Scale pattern analysis. Very important to understanding, when things happen. You can use salmon scales, and the time, lines on salmon scales to tell you, when things happened, when growth happened. Greg Rigoroni, I saw Greg on the sidewalk. I think he's in here somewhere. Has done a lot of work with this, as has Kate Myers on our program. And then otolith mass marks. They can put marks on every hatchery fish they release by changing the incubation temperatures sharply. They put a barcode on the ear bone of the salmon. So it's cheap to mark billions of salmon that are released into the ocean. Again, we need to go find these fish and see where they are, so that we can understand the migratory pathways of these animals. How will nearshore surveys and process studies help in understanding the productivity and abundance trends? Again, put this up in closing. This is the cleanest stock recruitment relationship that I've ever seen in 36 years. Is this going to fail in the future? Well, yes, of course it is. The other thing I can tell you from 36 years of this kind of work is that bivariate relationships almost eventually always fail. But that doesn't mean that we don't keep trying to understand where they are. Overwinter survival is sometimes very important. We just don't have the observational programs out there to give us the extra information that we need to make that connection. And I want to point out that this work is not only done by Joe Orsi, but at our lab, Emily Ferguson, Molly Sturdivant, and Alex Wertheimer. And, of course, on our panel, we have the father of the program, Bill Hurd. So that's the end, and I guess we wait for questions.
Come on back up, Phil. It's time for clarifying questions from the panelists.
You talked to, you gave a good overview of some of the research that has been done to date on salmon in the marine environment, and I was just wanting to get your thoughts on what you think is our best investment moving forward in terms of marine research.
Yeah, that's a tough question, but it's an important question. I think the experience that we have from the sea program in Prince William Sound, Seacombe survey and Basis survey indicates that we can find juvenile salmon in the marine environment. It's not easy, and as I mentioned, it's bathymetry and hydrography. You've got to take advantage of the local circumstances to find the fish. People who fish for a living know that very well. But I think the best thing that we could do is to figure out where juvenile Chinook are in the coastal environment. I think it's a really important problem. I think in the case of most of our big rivers, like the Yukon and the Kuskokwim, we have very little idea where these fish are when they're in the nearshore marine environment. I think that's the most important thing for us to do.
Would you please identify yourself as well for the...
Massive otolith marking of hackerfish, and then suggested that what we really need to do is to go find these fish in the ocean, which you just addressed. So, and you described some programs that are underway already that are looking for those fish. And the question I would have is looking to the future is how can we implement and find the support to do additional sampling in the ocean to look for more of those marked fish?
Yeah, well, now he wants me to be the director, the guy who's got the money, and I wish I had the money. I think it's really important. I mean, salmon being a marine species, from my point of view, it might seem odd to some people that we don't spend more of our research budget studying salmon in the marine environment. That having been said, now people are saying, "Oh, he's trying to take my money." Well, no. I think we need to push hard to get the oceanographic community, the marine science community in the North Pacific, and there's a lot of money here. You go out there in the summertime and you'll meet people from Texas A&M University, from Woods Hole, from Scripps. People from all over the world come to our waters every year to study the climate change, and the Arctic is a very big deal nationally and internationally now. I think we need to heighten the awareness of people who go out on research vessels about our needs, and we need to watch for these ships of opportunity, these platforms of opportunity, and try to get them to drag a net through the water every now and then. We have a brand new oceanographic research vessel coming online with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and it's northern capable. It can work in the north. It's not sensitive of the ice, so I think we need to push hard to see that we get salmon studies on those platforms.